Hey, have you ever noticed how your palate changes when the weather warms up? And how suddenly you start craving lighter, fresher things, both in what you eat and what you drink? Well, New York Times food columnist Alyssa Clark has been thinking about how to lighten up cocktails, which is really a good idea as we get into day drinking season. So she turned to a drinks expert for help, Talia Baiocchi, editor-in-chief of Punch.
Talia, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So summer is around the corner, and in summer, people like to drink low-alcohol beverages. Can you give us some ideas of how we can do that?
Yeah. So I think maybe the first place to start is with the session beer. It's become a buzzword in the beer world, sessionability or a session IPA. And this essentially means beers that are intentionally lower in alcohol that you can drink more of.
Okay.
And you see that word now applied to cocktails as well, which is really interesting.
A session cocktail?
A session cocktail.
So isn't that what we would normally think of as an aperitif, like a low-alcohol cocktail?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, aperitif has become synonymous with low-alcohol.
And now it's also synonymous with session.
With session.
Wow.
This is a buzzword.
I'm learning things. This is great. So tell me about session beers, because I know I've always thought that beers were lower in alcohol. I mean, generally, a pretty low-alcohol option.
Yeah. So beer in the mid-2000s went through this era of becoming higher alcohol. You had IPAs that were sort of pushing the level of bitterness and also pushing the level of alcohol. So you had beers that would crest into the double-digit mark in terms of ABV, which then almost gets into wine zone.
Yeah.
And over the past several years, you've seen the pendulum sort of switch back in the opposite direction. And this the quest by a lot of brewers to brew lower-alcohol beers that you can drink more than one of. Beers that don't need to be ice cold to in order for you to like really drink them and feel refreshed.
I see. So they can sell you more beers and you won't get as drunk.
Yes, that's another part of it. Yes, they can sell you twice as many beers.
But that's also good for people who want just a little something.
Yeah.
So what about wine? Are there wines that are lower than traditional wines, lower alcohol?
Yeah, absolutely. So wine went through a similar phase as beer. And we all remember the era of Napa Cab and those wines kind of pushing their level of ripeness and alcohol up into the 15%, 16% alcohol zone.
Which is basically like drinking a fortified wine.
Which is like drinking sherry. Yeah, exactly. Fino and Manzanilla sherry. So wine went through a similar sort of backing off of that trend towards wines that are higher in acid and lower in alcohol. So you see the rise of the Loire Valley as a place that people are particularly excited about right now. And that is a sort of a mecca for these kinds of wines. See the rise of Riesling from Germany, particularly the Mosel. And those wines can sometimes be as low as, you know, 7, 8% ABV.
Now, is that what they naturally are, or are winemakers making them differently so that they will be lower in alcohol?
They're intentionally making these wines at that level of alcohol. So these are wines that typically have residual sugar.
I
so the fermentation does not go completely through, and so you have a lower alcohol percentage.
So when you're talking low alcohol wines, you're usually talking sweeter wines.
Not always.
Okay.
In the case of Riesling, that's often true, but you have wines that can be 11, 12% alcohol that are completely dry.
Okay, and those would be like the Loire Valley.
Yeah, you see that in Muscadet sometimes. Mm-hmm. You also see that in Pet Nat, which is another sort of buzzword in wine. It means Petit Natural.
Oh, okay, right.
Which are these sparkling wines that finish their fermentation without any addition of sugar or yeast in the bottle. So they're oftentimes completely dry, but usually around 10% alcohol.
Now let's talk about aperitifs, which are my personal summer favorite. I love a Campari soda. That's my summer drink.
I'm with you all the way.
So I know that you just wrote a book on spritz cocktails. So obviously these are the kind of aperitifs. Tell me about them.
Exactly. So I think for most people, when they hear the word spritz, they think of the white wine spritzer in the 1980s, which was essentially like a sort of a half-hearted diet fad. It was a way to basically lower the calorie intake of your wine. Today, in America, you're seeing the rise of the actual spritz, which is the Italian spritz, which includes the addition of a bitter liqueur, typically Prosecco, a little bit of soda water, and ice. And that drink typically clocks in around 11% alcohol all told, depending on your bitter base.
Now, if someone wanted to make one of these at home, how do they do that? What are the staples? I mean, I have Campari, but what else would I have?
So the architecture of a spritz is really simple. So it's bitter, bubbly, and low alcohol. So within that framework, there are a lot of things that you can do. For me, it's always having on hand a selection of bitter liqueurs. Campari, of course, is the classic. Aperol is also classic. Then you have things like Cappelletti, which is a wine-based bitter. Cocchi Americano. It's endless. And these are not just limited to Italian liqueurs. They're also French liqueurs. There are liqueurs that are, you know, Swiss liqueurs that are bitter as well that you can use as a base for the spritz. In addition to that, you want either Prosecco or wine, and then soda water. The bubbliness is key to the spritz. Bubbliness,
exactly.
There's a reason why people go to champagne for celebration. There is something about effervescence that just attracts you and pulls you in.
Now, in your book, you talk about the rise of soda water as being sort of the key to the whole spritz universe and the creation of spritzes. And, you know, we had in America, we also had a rise of soda water, and we made sweet sodas. But in Europe, they made very bitter cocktails.
Yeah, I mean, the Italians have long been really obsessed with digestion and bitter. And in America, we have kind of gone in opposite directions. Sweetness has always been part of our sort of collective palate. And so this is really fairly new phenomenon that the spritz or drinks like the Negroni have really made headway.
So whenever I go to Europe, I always notice that, you know, at the end of the day, people sit down and they have an aperitif and the rest of the day will melt. And that's something that we don't really do as much here. Can you tell me maybe why culturally that's different and how do we get there?
We really need to get there. So I really do think that this trend towards low alcohol, the rise of the spritz, the rise of the session beer, all of this is pointing in the direction of us finding a way to adopt some of this, you know, this slowness, this moment in the day that is so important to particularly the Italian lifestyle. It's that moment of unwinding. And these drinks are paramount to that moment. The spritz has become a symbol of the good life, of la dolce vita in Italy, because leisure is so important to Italian identity. And we, I think, you know, especially in a city like New York, happy hour means something a little different. It's like, how do you stuff as many drinks into a very small space at a lower cost? And I think we are learning with the rise of these, you know, lower alcohol cocktails meant to be sipped and savored, that this is something we need the lifestyle along with the drink.
Right. We need to ease into it and not plunge.
Yeah, it's a slower approach to drinking, really.
Talia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Talia Biocchi is the editor-in-chief of Punch and co-author, with Leslie Parisot, of Spritz, Italy's most iconic aperitivo cocktail with recipes. Melissa Clark is author of Cook This Now. Talia left us a recipe for a classic. Find her Venetian Spritzer at splendidtable.org.